No doubt most of you here have received in the mail at different times a sweepstakes either from Publishers Clearinghouse or the American Family Publishers. And a few years ago in Bushnell, Florida, if you ever traveled on I-75 coming down toward Tampa, there's a little town called Bushnell right there. And there's a church there, the Church of God at Bushnell. And somehow they had gotten on the mailing list of American Family Publishers sweepstakes. Well, it's the Church of God at Bushnell, and the computer kind of cut that off and sent them a few years ago a sweepstakes addressed to God of Bushnell. And the letter read like this: Dear God, we're searching for you. We've positively identified you as our $11 million mystery millionaire. The letter went on to say, what an incredible fortune would be for you, God. Just imagine the looks that you would get from your neighbors. Don't just sit there, God. Come forward now and claim your prize. Well, when I come across that faux pas, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if people were indeed searching for God? It seems that many people, like the French philosopher said, have a God-shaped vacuum or void in their lives. And what a great thing it would be if people realize that it's in whom God, in whom we live and move and sustain our very being. But unfortunately, a lot of people are not doing that. Like the old song lamented back in my day that said, looking for love in all the wrong places. Well, a lot of people are looking for God in all the wrong places. And so this morning, I want us to take the text that was read in your hearing in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And I want us to focus particularly upon the phrase that speaks about the God of this age and how that God commanded the light to shine out of darkness, and yet there are those that are in darkness that are allowing the God of this age to have an impact upon them. This series, this lesson, comes from a series that I was asked to preach in a meeting in Kettering, Ohio. And I was just there, in fact, Sunday, where we did this. And the elders there have been working on the theme of out of darkness into the light. And so they asked me to come in and work up 6 lessons on light and darkness. Now, Fred, I might have had 1 lesson on light and darkness in 40 years. And I had to come up with 6, so this was all new material. And they seemed to receive it well. And I got to thinking, well, when I come back here, I'll just pick a couple of these lessons and share them with you. And so this morning we want to look at this lesson, the God of this age, and then tonight talk about what fellowship has light with darkness. Let me thank you so much for the invitation to Norm and me to come back and to be with you all here at Hickman Mills again and get to know you all better. We had a delightful time last night at the potluck, and if you missed out on that, then you missed out on some good food. We had a wonderful time of fellowship and eating together and enjoying getting to know each other better. And I appreciate the opportunity for that and look forward to the other opportunities today as well. I appreciate the kind words that have been extended to us. And even when we were here before, calls and emails and Facebook posts and different things like that certainly warmed our hearts. And we're glad that we can come back and be with you again and share some things together and get to know each other a little better. And, you know, when you're doing this, you kind of think about lessons that you're presenting. And I kind of had a little bit of a theme last time I was here. And so I thought this study on light and darkness might be a good thing for us to look at. And it gives you a chance to hear a side of me a little bit that you didn't hear last time, and some things that I think in this day and age are very important to us. Well, as we look here at the idea of the God of this age, one question certainly might come to our mind, that who is the God of this age that we're talking about? And I suggest certainly in the text it's not talking about Jehovah God. That God is not hidden, as the text talks about. That God is not veiled in some way. God is not blinding people. But the God that is being talked about in this text is the God, little g, or the ruler of this world. Jesus spoke of him in the book of John in chapter 12, in verses 31 and 32. He said, now this is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And then in John 14 and verse 30, he says, I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. The Apostle Paul, when he was writing to the brethren at Ephesus, expressed him this way. He said, and you has he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, according to the course of this world, and according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. So who is this? Well, if you haven't figured out already, he tells us in chapter 6 and verses 11 and 12. He said, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you might be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and against powers and against the rulers of the darkness of this age and against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. And so the one that is the God of this age is the prince of the power of the air. He is a spirit that works in the sons of disobedience. He is none other than the devil himself. That is the one that is being referred to here. Now, sometimes we think about this. Well, wait a minute. How does he rule? Isn't God all powerful? Isn't Jesus King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Isn't the Holy Spirit sent to dwell in us and provide an incentive to holiness in our lives? And so how is it Paul can say that he rules? Well, he rules in his realm in terms of the world of darkness, the world of sin, that sphere of wickedness that is identified as worldliness. You know, the Bible uses the term world in three different ways. In John 3:16, it said, God so loved the world. And we know that. There, Jesus is talking about the people of the world, isn't he? But then over in 1 John 2, John says, love not the world. Well, that almost sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Jesus, God loved the world, but here it says, love not the world in 1 John 2:15. Well, there he's talking about the sphere of wickedness. And then, of course, the word world is used to refer to cosmos. In Acts 17, God made the world. And so when we're studying the Bible, we have to look at the usage of the word. And so the God of this world is the way the world is used in 1 John 2:15. It is that sphere or that realm of wickedness, of ungodliness, of materialism, of carnality, of things that pertain to what we think of this world and not the spiritual world, not the things of God. And so how does the God of this age or this world attain his godship? Well, one way is by default. If Jehovah is not our God, then the devil will be. And so sometimes the God of this world, the devil, gets a foothold in people simply because they choose not to serve God. And so I call that by default. And it may be by voluntary submission. I would imagine for most of us in the room this morning, that's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine the idea of a person saying, you know what, I think I'll just serve the devil. Do you know people, there are people in this world that do? A number of years ago, Norm and I were living in Louisville, Kentucky, and a friend that lived down in Bowling Green, in fact, still lives there, Bob Buchanan, I don't know if you know that name or not, but Bob was going around the country doing a series on Satanism. And I was amazed at the foothold that Satanism has developed in our culture. The Church of Satan started out in California a number of years ago. I think a fellow by the name of Petty is the guy that started. But nevertheless, he started this Church of Satan for people that want to be Satan worshipers. And so when the Church of Satan decided to evangelize and target a city, you know where they targeted? Louisville, Kentucky. Now, don't ask me why Louisville, Kentucky exactly, but that's where they targeted. And I found out from Bob there was all kinds of satanic practices that were going on in that area, especially out in the rural areas down in Bullock County, of people that were offering sacrifices to Satan, and the police were finding all kinds of weird things that were going on. And he said, the news media doesn't really want to talk about this, but you begin to piece it together, there were Satan worshipers that lived in that area. And it may not be as pervasive as other things, or you think, but there are people in this culture today that actually voluntarily decide to submit to Satan. And then a third way he gains a foothold is by God giving up on those that seek to do evil. Now that may sound a little strange to us because we say, well, God never gives up. Well, I beg to differ. In Romans chapter 1, when Paul described the sins of the Gentile world three times, in Romans 1, he says, God gave them up. He gave them up to their own lust. He gave them up to do those things that were not fitting or convenient or right. God gave them up to ungodliness or unrighteousness. God gave them up. Why? Because their mind and heart was set upon doing evil. And when we reach that point, then we fall under the reign of the God of this world. Well, according to the text that Brandon read, what does the God of this age or the God of this world do? Well, the first thing he read there was he hides the gospel truth. The devil does not want us to see truth. And so he seeks to hide it. I think the version maybe he read says veiled. It is veiled, covered up, hidden. And so the devil does everything he can to disguise truth so we can't recognize it. And in fact, in the verse there, verse 3, if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing. Not to those that are being saved, it's veiled to those that are perishing. It is hidden from them. But the second thing the text says it does, that he blinds us to the light. Now, Jesus also spoke of this in John chapter 12 and in verse 40. He said he has blinded their eyes, as he quotes from Isaiah, and hardened their hearts, lest they should see with their eyes, lest they understand with their hearts, and turn so that I should heal them. And so the God of this age hides truth, and he seeks to blind us to keep us from being able to see clearly what the truth of God is. Now, the question comes, how does the devil do it? Now, you have all these caricatures in comics, you know, and you picture the devil with horns and a long tail and a pitchfork and all this kind of stuff, and people dress up on Halloween and so forth. But the devil didn't work that way. The devil uses agency, and he works through people. In fact, it says the devil even has his angels, and he works through people, and he works through agency to accomplish this. And he does it, I think I can sum up the 3 points I'm going to make in two words. He does it through truth decay. People today don't value truth. They value convenience. They ask the question, is it easy and is it convenient and does it work? Now, philosophically, that's called pragmatism. Now, I suppose there are some things that's okay. I was in a meeting last fall in East Alton, Illinois, just on the other side of St. Louis. Cameron's familiar with that area, I guess. And one of the elders there said, on Sunday night, a bunch of us go out together. I want to take you out to eat. Well, I have a policy about that. When brethren offer to take me out to eat, I go. It's been a good policy through the years, except for that time, because he said, we're going to McDonald's. And I said, really? He goes, yeah. And he said, why, you don't like McDonald's? I said, well, it's been about 20 years since I've eaten at McDonald's. He said, you're kidding. I said, well, now, my wife and I do stop there for coffee sometimes when we're traveling. But no, since our kids got grown, we don't eat at McDonald's anymore. You know. He said, well, that's where we all go. So I said, okay. And so I ate at McDonald's that night. Well, we were waiting. And it took forever to get our food. And I'm standing there, Brad kind of grumbling and mumbling. I'm saying, is this fast food? I thought this was fast food. Why? Because we want it now, don't we? You know, a few years ago when we had the old-fashioned coffee pot, I said, this is too slow. Got to get up in the morning, wait forever for that coffee to perk, you know? And so I got a bun coffee maker. You have a bun, you know, that has the water already hot? And so I can go in and I can pour it in that tank and then the hot water drains through. And by the time I come back out there, the coffee's made. Why? I want it right now. I want it quick. I want it convenient. I want it easy. And that's our culture today. Microwave it. Instant. That's our lives. You know, that's okay, I guess, when it comes to coffee and food and a few things like that. But it's not okay when it comes to religious matters. It's not okay when we just say, is it easy? Is it convenient? Is it quick? Because then we get away from what God's truth is. Well, how does he do this? Well, he decays truth through individualism. Individualism. Individualism means that I live for myself. I'm my own standard. I can only judge what's right and wrong. In other words, it simply says I'm my own God. Some time ago, the Wall Street Journal did a survey of business executives across America, and they discovered that when business executives have an ethical crisis, 44% of them said, I consult with myself. Yeah, only 3% said they consult with God. In other words, they're setting themselves up as their own standard. And we say, you know, I need to get inside myself. And so I'll get inside myself and I'll figure out the answer to this. And that's kind of like I'm becoming my own God. A few years ago, there was a book written by a fellow by the name of Robert Bella entitled Habits of the Heart. And he describes some of the kind of cultural changes that have gone on in America in the past 40 years. And in doing so, he interviewed a number of people, and he interviewed a young lady by the name of Sheila, a single lady, was a nurse. And Sheila told Mr. Bella that she believed in God, but she wasn't a religious fanatic. And she said, I can't remember the last time that I've been to church. She said this, and I quote, my faith has carried me a long way. It's Sheilaism. Just my own little voice. Sheilaism. That means I'm my own God. And so I determine for myself what's right, what's wrong. Kenism, Normaism, Brianism, Steveism, Donism. We all just become our own gods. And the devil works through us to try to accomplish that. But you know, that's not anything new. In the Old Testament, the book of Judges, it said there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's our value system for many people in our culture today. I become my own God. I decide when it's right or wrong for me. A few years ago, there was a sitcom. I didn't watch it, but I read about it. Because it had kind of a brassy-mouthed woman on there and a couple kids. And it just kind of went against the culture and the morals of a lot of things that I believe in. But I read on this one show where this lady, this couple's teenage daughter is talking to the mother. And the teenage daughter was being pressured by her boyfriend to have sexual relations. And the mother said to the 16-year-old daughter, honey, you will know when it's right for you. Not it's wrong outside of marriage, not wait till you're married, but you will know when it's right for you. That's individualism. That's I'm my own God. I'll decide what's right and wrong. Well, a second way the devil does this is through secularism. Secularism. That simply says God's unnecessary. Secular people don't necessarily not believe in God. They just feel that we can get along okay without him. In fact, the mantra today of the secular folks in our country is keep religion away from public life. Say, let's separate any vestige of religion from our schools and from our government or anything in public life. And it's kind of an attitude that says, we just don't need God very much. And so what has happened in the past 40 to 50 years, we have systematically been removing God from schools, government, media, to newspapers, and in some cases, even churches. When I was a kid growing up in Indiana, back in the, just a few short years ago, more people went to church than didn't. Some of you of my generation remember that. Now it's just reversed. More people don't go to church than do go to church. And our nation has become very secular in its approach to things. And we say, well, where do people get their morals and their ethics and their values? Well, from shows like I just mentioned. And then people watch those kind of things. And people watch talk shows. And what do the celebrities believe? And there's all kinds of websites and people really interested in what's going on with celebrities and what their stand is on different issues. People watch shows like, used to be on like Jerry Springer. You ever watch Jerry Springer? Well, you don't have to watch it. You know how bizarre and ridiculous and wild it is. There's the commercials that would come on. I think it's still on some cable stations. But I just went on the internet, and here are some of the titles of some shows that Springer's had on in the past. Love Triangle Episodes. I Have Six Wives. My Sister Stole My Man. Leave My Man Alone. Couples in Crisis. I'm Sleeping With Your Man. My Boyfriend Is a Girl. Huh? Yeah, My Boyfriend Is a Girl. Wild Affairs. I'm Marrying My Sister. I mean, on and on. Ridiculous. Bizarre. And they would almost, and they get people on those shows, and the audience hoots and hollers and claps, goes, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. And people just have a big old time, and folks get the notion that's what's going on in our world today. And there's not any practice or any idea or any lifestyle that's too bizarre if you want to engage in it. You know, they got to scour the country, by the way, to find people that are that bizarre. They're not that common. There's a lot of them around, but they're not just finding them everywhere. It's a small percentage of our society. Romans chapter 1 describes the secular attitude. And it's nothing new. That the Gentile world had sunk to that. Let me just take the time and take a moment to read a few verses to you out of Romans chapter 1. And he talks about how that they were without excuse and that they did not glorify God. It says in verse 21 that although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, neither were they thankful, but they became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and beasts. And here's the phrase I mentioned earlier. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanliness and the lust of their flesh and the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than a creator who is blessed forevermore. That is secularism. How does the God of this age impact us? Through relativism. Now, I'm not talking there about bad relatives, because we all probably have some. But relativism can be summed up in two words. It is no absolutes. And no absolutes, it just fits into this whole package, is simply this. What's truth for me may not be truth for you, and what's truth for you may not be truth for me. That way there's no guilt. You see, it's a lowering of the bar where no one feels bad about anything that they're doing. Because everything is all relative. There are no absolutes. You know, one of the things I've noticed living in Tampa, and we've had a lot of college students where I used to preach, and not just Florida college students, but students from University of South Florida and other places, that one young lady that some of our students started bringing was a USF student, and she came several times. And so one day I kind of sidled up to her, and I said, Hannah, you've really been coming a lot. And I said, we're liking it. We like seeing you. She kind of giggled, and I said, hey, listen, have you ever thought if the preacher had some time to visit with you, you might have some questions, what's going on, and what you hear me preach, and so forth. She said, yeah, I do have some questions. I said, well, how about us get together, and you just write your questions down, and we'll just kind of go over them and talk about them and get our Bibles out and find the answers. And so that's kind of the way I approach it, because most of these young people, she didn't have a church background anywhere. See, when I first started preaching a few years ago, everybody, like I say, went to church. And so people knew stuff. The first time that hit me, Lily, was this. I was studying with a lady, and I said, you know, it's kind of like when Abraham, and I went into this story about Abraham, and she looked at me and she said, who's Abraham? She hadn't gone to Sunday school. She didn't know anything about who Abraham was. So I learned people don't know the Bible anymore. They used to go to churches, even though they may taught some things doctrinally wrong. They just don't go to church and know the Bible. So she was kind of like that. So you kind of start at square one, you know, and deal with Bible authority and some things. But in the midst of this discussion, the issue of truth came up. And I said to her, have you ever taken a philosophy course at USF? She said, yeah. I said, did the professor ever say in that philosophy course there are no absolutes? She looked at me as if, how did you know? She said, yeah. I said, think about what your professor said. There are no absolutes. Isn't that an absolute? Think about it. But that's the attitude in academia today. And that lowers the bar. And so we just, everything's relative. You know, we play Scrabble. Anybody play Scrabble? Yeah? Well, suppose we're playing Scrabble, and I come up with an unrecognizable word, and you say, that's not a word, and I say it is too, and I get 57 points. Now, how are we going to solve that? Well, in the old days, we got a dictionary out. Today, we just have our computer there, and, you know, we go to dictionary.com and you know, type in the word. And I am kind of bad of making up words, I will admit. But usually either our son or our daughter-in-law is really good at Scrabble, and she'll call me on it. I say, okay, you want to miss it? If you're wrong, you're going to lose a turn. That's not a word. And they look it up, and lo and behold, it's not a word. No 57 points. But everything's relative. Yes, it's a word, and I get 57 points because it doesn't make any difference. No. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. There is absolute truth. And yet today people value tolerance more than they value truth. And by the way, you know tolerance has changed its meaning? Did you know that? Used to, tolerance meant that we have respect for people with whom we disagree. Okay? And that you treat people with civility and you have tolerance. Now, people in the world have changed the idea of tolerance that I must go along with it. I must embrace it. I must celebrate it. I must say it's a wonderful thing. And if I dare, in a venue like this, say that something is wrong, I'm an intolerant bigot. To dare condemn someone's lifestyle. If it's truth, it's truth. If it's not truth, I'm going to condemn it. And I'm going to say that it's wrong. Well, what's the answer to all this? Three things based on our text. One is the light of knowledge. You know, there is power in knowledge, isn't there? And that's true in every realm of life. When I was working on this series, I came across a kind of an interesting story that happened 500 years ago. And it was when Columbus was making one of his voyages to the New World. It was actually 1504. And they came to the coast of Jamaica, and they depleted most of their supplies. And so they were in desperate need of fresh food and water, and the native Jamaicans refused to trade. And Columbus begged, and he pleaded, and he threatened, but to no avail. Now, he could have chosen to attack the natives there in Jamaica, but he knew that was suicidal, and that they were heavily armed, and the situation looked hopeless. Well, one night as Columbus was looking at the Navigator's Almanac, he came across some information that was potentially meaningful and helpful in this situation. He discovered in a couple of days there was a lunar eclipse, and so he thought, how am I going to use this? So the day the eclipse was to occur, he went to the chief there on the island, and he again asked for fresh fruit and food and water, and again they denied the request to trade. And so he said, well, he would have no choice but to use his magical powers that night and to blot out the moon. And if they still didn't trade, the next day he would call the sun down to send fire and burn up their villages. Well, you know what happened. That night, the lunar eclipse occurred, and the natives became scared, and they ran to Columbus. They begged Columbus, please, let us trade with you. We'll give you food and water. And Columbus said, okay, and I'll bring the moon back out. And, of course, then the moon came back out, and Columbus got his way. Well, that's just an illustration of the power of knowledge. But a much more meaningful way is the knowledge that we have of God and how that his word lights our way. And Psalm 119:105, the psalmist said, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. It lights where we're going. It directs us. Peter put it this way. He said, and so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star arises in your heart. The answer to the God of this world and the darkness in which he seeks to engulf us is the light of knowledge. And then secondly, to realize that the source of that light is God. That God is light. In 1 John chapter 1 and in verse 5, John said, this is a message which we've heard from him and declare to you that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. He is the author of all light, physical light as well as spiritual light. In James chapter 1 and verse 17, James said, every good gift and perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there's neither shadow or variation or shadow cast by turning. I'm going to have more tonight to say about God being light. But suffice it to say, he is the source of light for you and I today. And then to find that light, we must come to Christ to find it. The prologue of John's gospel, John 1. John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. More than once, John records Jesus saying, I am the light of the world. And he is. Not Muhammad, not Buddha, not mysticism, not transcendental meditation, not creeds or catechisms, but Jesus. And I know a lot of people today are offended when you say the name Jesus. But he said, I'm the way, the truth, and life. He is the light of the world. And we must come to Jesus in order to understand truth and to overcome the darkness that is in this world. And so what I'm saying to you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is the God of this age is a threat. He's a threat to our young people here. He's a threat to young parents. He's a threat to grandparents. He is a threat to the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And we must seek to overcome the God of this age. If you're using a hymn book, you can go ahead and turn to it. In just a moment, we'll sing the song the apostle selected for us. But I'm going to close a little story that I think brings home this point in my mind in a dramatic fashion. Some of you may be fans of James Michener, the author, and he wrote a book a number of years ago entitled The Source. And in that book, Michener tells a story about a man by the name of Urbel. He lived at 2200 BC and was a farmer. And Urbel worshiped two gods. He worshiped the god of death and he worshiped the god of fertility. One day the temple priest came and asked Urbel and other men to bring their young sons to the temple for sacrifice if they wanted good crops. And so on the appointed day, Urbel obeys and he drags his wife and his young son to the site of the religious execution to the god of death. After the sacrifice of Urbel's boy and others, the priest then announced that one of the fathers will be chosen to spend the next week in the temple with the new temple prostitute. Mission records that Urbel's wife is stunned as she notices an intense desire that comes across his face like she had never seen before. And then she is overwhelmed when he is the one that is called to claim his prize. The scene is over and Urbel stays and his wife leaves. Her head is swimming. Her son has been put to death in this execution. Her husband has stayed behind with the temple prostitute. And then she says these words, if he had different gods, he would have been a different man. Who's your God? And you might say, well, wait a minute, Ken. You're here in Kansas City, Missouri. We don't worship idols. We don't worship gods like Urbel in 22 BC. We don't worship gods like that. We're not idolaters. Who's your God? You know, it doesn't have to be that kind of a God. It can be the kind of gods we were talking about in our Bible class, the God of money or a power or position, sports. Yeah. Who's your God? Because I submit to you that whoever your God is, whoever is at the center of your life, that really you're worshiping, whether you come here on a regular basis or not, but whoever it is that you really worship, you will become like that God. You want to be a different person? Come to Jehovah God. Come to His Son, Jesus Christ. And come to the cross. And come to serve and accept and obey Him. So we close our worship this morning. We sing the song that Paul selected. If you have a duty to God and we can help you in some way to come to the truth, to come out of darkness into the light, where there's confession of sins that may have reproached your life and stained the name of Jesus, or whether you're not a Christian and through other studies you've learned what to do through faith and repentance and baptism to take the blood of Jesus that God will apply to your sin-stained soul and cleanse you, raise you up in newness of life to walk in the light, and have the hope and privileges that He's promised. If we can help you with that, we'd love to minister to you. While together we stand.